Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Ever wonder why textbooks are so expensive? How fondue pots came to be on every wedding registry? Why there are so few female computer programmers? Our friends at Planet Money answer great questions like these on their podcast. They have new episodes every Wednesday and Friday, and you can find them on iTunes. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll be talking about Christopher Nolan's big new space exploration adventure, Interstellar. And jumping off of that, we'll talk about some other space movies as well and some hard science fiction. And we'll hopefully find some answers about what lies beyond the edge of the galaxy. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our pal, Chris Klimek. Chris, when you are not appearing on Pop Culture Happy Hour, what do you do?
I am recently an editor at Smithsonian Air and Space, and I'm a movie critic for The Dissolve and for You and for Village Voice, cosmos-wide.
Fantastic.
Whenever something large smashes into something else large on the big screen, we bring in our pal Chris.
Chris Klimek is there. Well, it's awfully good to see Chris and to see all of you. As many of you know, I was on vacation last week, so I'm chomping at the bit to get back into this routine. So Interstellar, as I said, is directed by Christopher Nolan, who directed the Dark Knight trilogy, as well as Memento and Inception. The screenplay is credited to him and his brother and frequent collaborator, Jonathan Nolan. It tells the story of a widower played by Matthew McConaughey who leaves his children with their grandfather to embark on an interstellar journey to save the world, which has fallen into a sort of disastrous climate-driven catastrophe. Also in the film are Anne Hathaway, Jessica Chastain, Michael Caine, Casey Affleck, John Lithgow, Wes Bentley, and the voice of Bill Irwin as R2-D2. No, not really. You know, before we got started here, I did want to mention that on the second ever episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, we talked about Inception. And Glenn Weldon had, I thought, a very interesting thing to say about Christopher Nolan movies. And so I want to hear that clip.
It's one of the digs against this film is that it feels kind of like the way a lot of Christopher Nolan films feel to me, which is sort of mechanical. It's a thing that you admire, but you don't necessarily love. The emotional stuff doesn't connect, which is odd because dreams technically are about sort of an emotional through line. That's what connects things piece to piece is just that you feel the same way about them, which is why it seems random and weird. It's because the thing that's telling the story is your emotions.
Sure.
And here, because it's so flatly laid out and well planned, it feels kind of cold.
So my question,
God,
I guess...
you sounded so young then.
I said sort of a lot more back then.
My first question goes to Glenn, and I just wanted to ask, in seeing Interstellar, I think one of the things that I noticed about it is it does seem to be a big swing, not only technically, but also emotionally. He's trying to tell this family story.
Much larger saline budget than Inception. Yeah, that's true.
Indeed. So I was wondering kind of how you reacted to Interstellar, looking at it from that kind of technical versus is it cold kind of way.
I'll put it this way. I was split on this film. We can tick down the, I got three against. But under emotional beats, I had it against because I just don't think he gets emotional beats. I don't think that's his strength. He does pay lip service to it, but as somebody who is struggling to understand these things you humans call emotions, I recognize somebody who's faking it.
Yeah.
I recognize a faker. There are so many reactions in this film that don't feel real. You don't understand why somebody is doing a thing or saying a thing or expressing a thing in a certain way. So that stuff just didn't connect.
I think it's fair to point out, by the way, that he does have a daughter, and people have talked about the fact that this is a film that is very much inspired by the way he feels about his daughter. So I don't know if I want to say faking it.
All right.
But I think in terms of not being able to translate it effectively.
Dramatizing it.
I think that the dramatization isn't persuasive for you.
There certainly are a lot of attempts at the plucking of heartstrings in this movie. There's a lot of intra-family back and forth and what one generation owes to another generation. There's a lot of very warm emo stuff in this movie. And as a somewhat emo guy,
somewhat,
I was amazed at how little it connected for me. I really struggled with this movie. I found it very frustrating and very unsatisfying in ways that I've spent the last day trying to not come to terms with, as if it's this gigantic weight on my shoulders.
Right, no, sure.
But I've read a lot of enormously positive reviews of this film and have been trying to figure out why it left me so cold. Yeah. I was very frustrated and disappointed.
How about you, Chris?
I think I'm still under the spell of it a little bit. I like Christopher Nolan movies. I feel like he is a unique presence. No one else who is, well, given that much money to work with, is collapsing and extending time in the same way that he is with editing, which is kind of what this film's about. It deals with relativity quite a lot, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure. I see all of the flaws that we're pointing out, and I actually don't disagree with any of them, but I'm willing to forgive this film a lot because I think I'm sort of starved for grandeur as a filmgoer.
One of the things that I noticed about this movie, you start off with roughly an hour that's really Matthew McConaughey as a farmer in this kind of dust bowl of the future. And he's got his kids and he's, you know, racing with his kids in his truck into a cornfield to chase a drone. And it's cool, right? And there's this, I started to think like, wow, you know, this is Nolan making a kind of a wonder movie,
right?
Like Close Encounters of the Third Kind and almost like a Spielberg-y movie.
And at one point, Spielberg was going to,
right,
to
exactly.
direct this.
And that's what I learned today as I was reading about it. Not only was Spielberg at one time set to direct this movie, but when Jonathan Nolan was working on the script to be directed by Spielberg, according to what I read in Entertainment Weekly, essentially the first hour that Matthew McConaughey stuff came from the writing for Spielberg. Christopher Nolan came in and, according to what I read, I'll read you kind of the description. It says he wanted to reshape the middle section, the exploration of planets. He wanted to play with scale and pit man against monolithic nature, dust storms, tidal waves, the spoiler in the last act. He wanted to round out the story's view of moral character with scenarios that depict humankind at its selfless best, selfish worst, and nuanced points in between. And I thought, oh, he added all the stuff I didn't like. But I'm serious when I say I really think the part of this movie that I responded to, that I really wanted to like, is the first section, which is that meant for Spielberg, you know, dad in the cornfield, which according to this was largely left alone. And what got fussed with is the space movie that then follows, which I liked much less.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
It's interesting that Glenn started off talking about the emotional beats not working, because for me, those stories did work. Like, I was affected by the stories of him and his kids. That stuff did connect for me. Chris mentioned that he's playing with time, and there are some consequences of the way they're playing with time and relativity and things like that that I thought were actually quite deeply moving, that I thought were the most resonant and most interesting and most profoundly effective parts of the film. But then, for me, it gets lost in this morass of switches and capsules and gravity and techno babble that just goes on and on and on. And I just didn't care. Like, the more it got into, like, you know, it's like a Dr. Seuss story where you're talking about putting the Fraggle Dee Nook in the Boonswaggle. Like, I just got bored by that part.
This is exactly how people reacted to James Cameron's The Abyss in 1989,
which is underwater instead
of in space. But, you know, there is this emotional story at the core of it. There are these astonishing performances from Ed Harris and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. Is this divorced couple that clearly still love each other, and, you know, that's kind of emerging in this crisis where there's this race of undersea creatures that we haven't encountered yet, and, you know, it's a Cold War kind of plot. There's a SEAL team on the rig with them that believes that the Russians are manipulating these things. But these are exactly what the response is to.
And I heard our friends at The Dissolve were talking about the same thing today, the comparison to The Abyss. So apparently that has been something that has really resonated for a lot of people who remember that response. I think that's clearly a thing.
Let me take off a couple of the other things that I objected to, I guess, about this film. I mean, he's not great at women. Now, this is a Hollywood thing more than
I noticed that.
Both of the significant female roles in this film are completely defined by their relationship with a dude. Again, it's tough to slag Nolan specifically on that. That seems like Hollywood script writing now. But there's a moment At the very end of this film, I'm not going to spoil it, but a person is asked why she did a thing she did, and the answer she gives was, to me, galling. There's also a moment earlier in the film where I hope it's an homage to the old kind of Forbidden Planet 50s cheesy science fiction films where two people would be running, invariably the woman would fall down and go, "My ankle, go on without me." And I hope it is an intentional homage, because why is that still happening? Mm-hmm. The production design of the first hour that you talked about, one of the reasons I love science fiction is I love seeing people's imagination as we push ourselves forward. What are we going to look like in 10 years, 20 years, a century, whatever? That section of the film seemed to be so much an homage to the Dust Bowl as to be a parody of it. There was no electronic equipment. We were completely there. Now, I understand why he did it. He wanted it to seem timeless. Mm-hmm. He wanted not to have us distracted by...
There's plenty of electronic equipment later.
I mean, yeah. This is kind of the approach that Looper took to the future
exactly.
as well. Where it says, you know, it seems to be about 1950,
near
even though it's you know, 70 years, whatever it is in the future.
The sound design of the film, this is me being a fogey. If you see this film in IMAX, there's 16 different ways to see it. Yeah. It is deafening. It is so loud. There is a single note that recurs two or three times over the course of the film that set up a sympathetic vibration in my ear. I felt myself, my eardrums shuddering. It was unpleasant. I felt like it was going to go all Scanners there for a second.
Yeah, and I want to bring that point up. All four of us saw this movie at the same time. I don't think that it was screened properly.
I actually missed dialogue a few points.
I missed dialogue a couple times, and I think that's the mixing. And I don't think you can blame the theater for that. But I will say, as I was reading around about this movie today, one of the other things that I found was that Nolan had very emphatically said, "I am doing the sound design to maximize the potential of all this new sound equipment that theaters have." On the Interstellar webpage, where it talks about the technical specifications, and it goes into the IMAX and all these formats, it says, "The sound on Interstellar has been specially mixed to maximize the power of the low-end frequencies in the main channels, as well as in the subwoofer channel. This effect is present in all available presentations of Interstellar, all of which have been designed to play back at the volume level designated by the industry at 7 on the Dolby Cinema processor."
But I'm not going to fix Bane's voice either.
But there was,
that's right.
But there was also an interview in which Nolan was basically, or an appearance he did, where he was basically saying, "Proper technical projection of this movie will be more important with this movie than in any other thing I've ever done because of both the picture and the sound." So I think it is possible that it's kind of a blend where he intentionally made it a thing that has to be done exactly right, or else it is just extremely unpleasant. Nothing makes me feel more like a fogey than watching part of a movie with my fingers in my ears.
Exactly.
But I did it anyway.
Also dungarees.
Well, and also dungarees. I mean, we have to talk about Hans Zimmer's score. Hans Zimmer's score in Inception is a big thing that everybody remembers. and there were people whose enjoyment of Inception was really affected by that insistent tone. To me, this movie has exactly the same problem, if not more so.
I agree.
I react a lot to music in movies, and my emotional response to movies I find is very often dictated by the way that music is played. I'm very easily manipulated by it. And I think one reason that I was not emotionally moved by all this stuff that has all sorts of triggers in my own life is in part that I found the music abrasive instead of warm. And there were points, now obviously in space you understand why you don't have warm music. I understand that decision. But the music in the film is never warm.
Yeah.
And it leads me to a larger criticism of the film for me. And I had a little bit of the same problem with Gravity, which is the formula for virtually every script in Hollywood. It follows a very consistent pattern. And one element of that pattern is that right near the end, there is an all is lost moment. Mm-hmm. There is a point at which everybody is at their lowest point. Everybody is in the most peril. The villain seems to have won. The good guys seem to have lost. Somebody appears to have died, et cetera, et cetera. This film sustains the all is lost moment for about 2 hours and 40 minutes. And it also sustains for that time the tense pitch of that. Mm-hmm. One of the effects that this had for me is that this movie felt interminably long. The 2 hours and 50 minutes, for me, it felt like 5 hours.
Yeah, you know,
But this was you on The Dark Knight Rises as
I
well,
was
right?
Say.
I think that, yeah, I think I like the sensation of being physically squeezed in a blockbuster a little bit more.
Who among us doesn't?
More than you guys. I like that visceral feeling of anxiety that you get in your stomach because it's so suspenseful. And I mean, yes, it is physically tiring. I like that. I like that that's what I can't get usually from watching a TV show or, you know, that comes from the communal experience of going to a movie in a movie theater and witnessing something of some scale.
The criticism that you always get when you say this movie is overlong is, and I think it's a fair criticism. People say, well, that's easy to say, but, you know, it's not like you haven't gone back and actually explained what your edit would look like and whatever. Mm-hmm. So I just want to take this opportunity to say, I know exactly what I would cut from this movie. There is an entire derail involving
An interpersonal conflict. I know exactly what you're talking about.
There is a, and it winds up with a fight that I think is really dumb looking. That I think
it's
is
kind of dumb looking. That was the Star Trek moment, though. I heard the Star Trek fight music.
It
was when I felt myself laugh at the movie where I knew I wasn't supposed to.
That scene does culminate in a beautiful piece of imagery.
I'm going to take off the stuff I really, really liked. I mean, this is a physics word problem brought to life in a way that is really legitimately, I don't want to say unpacked, but meditated over, thoughtful.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, if you read science fiction, you come across this all the time. But here in a blockbuster was a really good exploration of exactly what this would look like. And someday the human race might have to deal with this, not in the next 5 years, not in the next 10, but maybe in 100, maybe in 1,000 years. This might be a thing that we actually have to worry about or at least deal with. And I thought it was really good. As you've all mentioned, this is a gorgeous looking film. It's ambitious. This generation has grown up with a lot of space flight stuff on television and in museums means that it doesn't feel like special effects to me. Mm-hmm. It felt real in a really basic way. And when this director wanted me to feel tense, I felt tense. There are moments of exhilaration. There are moments of just, there was a grin on my face because I was having so much fun at this film. And I will say,
I do not think that they did much to bring anything new to either the concept of going through a black hole or the concept of going through a wormhole, both of which look like a 1970s music video.
Sure.
And those are actually the scientifically valid aspects of this movie. Kip Thorne, the Caltech theoretical physicist who is credited as a producer and actually was credited as a writer on an early draft of this, he supplied this arrangement with Christopher Nolan where he said that, you know, we're going to code the data you give us, and if it doesn't look like anything that filmgoers can understand, we're going to have to just make it up. But apparently what you saw in the movie is actually what Kip Thorne believes.
Well, then all hail the 1970s music video.
Maybe they got it right in the 70s.
All I'm saying is it looked exactly like everything I've seen.
Okay, but there's a rigor to the approach here. Like, I love it whenever I see something happen in space and there's no sound on screen.
That was great.
Yeah. That, I'm always frustrated when showrunners or directors say, well, the studio wanted us to put in sound in space, or the network wanted to put us in sound. Because when we have that disconnect between what we see and what we don't hear, that has an emotional force that is much stronger than if you just, you know, and because we react to it emotionally and then we process it intellectually, and it just has such a huge power. And it's used really well here. It's sometimes muted by the music a lot of times and by the sound. That's the stuff I loved. I am split on this movie. I can't wait to see it again under a more controlled environment where I control the sound.
You know, there is at least one sonic cue that I really love that stands out in my mind where Cooper, Matthew McConaughey's character, is speaking to one of the other astronauts. I don't remember his name, unfortunately, but he gives him his earbuds.
Yeah.
He says, here, listen to this to calm down. And he's listening to, like, thunderstorm sounds, you know, just to relax. And that's what we hear as we cut to this faraway shot of the Endurance just pinwheeling across the wings of Saturn. It's a little speck in front of this vast planet. And I loved that shot.
I really appreciated the enormous reach of this movie.
That's what I mean when I say big swing.
It is a very, very big swing. And I think there are elements of it that are very beautiful. There are elements of it that are kind of awe-inspiring filmmaking. But it ultimately, for me, just crashed together in a film that I had a very difficult time finding a way into.
I think for me, having him sort of dabble in that idea of, first of all, a movie where it's not full of people getting shot, which is one of the things we didn't care for about Inception, was that there was so much gunplay. It's not dark and gritty and rainy streets like the Batman movies. I mean, he is doing some different things, and I think applying his skill to a different kind of story, I appreciate it and I respect. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's safe to say that a lot of you are going to wind up seeing this movie, most likely. I will be really interested to see how it's received, and yeah, I'll be really interested to see how those of you who are listening feel about it. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And so the other thing that we were going to talk about this week actually is a very close cousin of what we have been talking about. We were just going to shift gears slightly and talk about, well, Chris, I think this was sort of your idea. I think this was a topic that you hatched a little bit.
Yeah, so my idea for a B topic was sort of realistic sci-fi, speculative sci-fi that isn't Star Wars or, you know, which is
Guardians
a long time ago
galaxy.
In a galaxy far, far away. Right. It's not, you know, science different fantasy. Civilizations all speaking the Queen's English together wearing the same clothes. You know, it's a legitimate attempt to imagine where we'll be. And, you know, there is kind of a small canon of films that are sort of emblematic of this, 2001 and Alien. And
yeah. Talk to me about you and 2001. Because I haven't seen it in a while, so I don't really have a recent mature impression of it to discuss. But talk to me about you in 2001.
I mean, it is the clear antecedent for so many things, but for Interstellar specifically.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. And I think there is a way in which that payoff that I was talking about not finding really satisfying is sort of the same reason why I watched the end of 2001 and I was like, whatever.
Oh, but you see, but in 2001, they don't tell you, you know?
No, whereas
they
explain true.
Actually, the first hour of Interstellar, the part that you liked so much, reminded me so much of the M. Night Shyamalan movie Signs. Mm. With
I think that's fair.
America's favorite widower dad, Mel Gibson.
now you're just trying to make me look stupid.
No, it was 2002. We didn't know.
We've talked about a couple of space movies on the show. We talked about Gravity.
Sure, which fits into this genre.
Mm-hmm.
Solaris, Sunshine, Moon, a really good film.
Yeah, you're just naming
I'm just naming
celestial
the films that
bodies.
That I think, well, that's also that.
No, I think Sunshine, too. I mean, that's a mission to save humanity using the scant resources remaining.
Okay, remind me what Sunshine is.
Sunshine is Danny Boyle's spacefaring adventure from 2007 where the sun is flaming out and humanity has pooled its last reserve of resources to send a bomb into space and basically try to jumpstart the sun. I'm sure it's all very scientifically sound.
Mm-hmm.
Good movie,
though. What else you got, Glenn?
Well, 2001, 2010, the year we make contact. Event Horizon, is sort of, and then it kind of goes into a whole weird place. A lot of these films go in a weird place at the end. The Abyss, weird place at the end. Dark Star, Gravity, Silent Running, Outland, Maroon, a film from 1969, where they're basically astronaut films. I think that's the way I think about it. So that's how we kind of
That's who's getting shot into space.
But it's interesting because that's not always true, because one of the ones that I had thought about after finding it on a list somewhere of movies in space, but one of the ones I thought was interesting to contemplate is Elysium, which is a space movie in a way, but not an astronaut movie exactly.
Sure.
It's sort of an adventure movie in a version of space, but it's not technically astronauts running around.
In books, they call this hard science fiction,
right?
Which means that it privileges scientific accuracy and technical detail. Ooh, sign me up. Can't wait. That sounds great. I mean, I've said this before. It's called science fiction, not science boring. Tell me a story.
Yes.
If you are so fixated on getting the accuracy of the technical details, it seems to me, I used to read a lot of hard science fiction when I was a teenager, and it's, you know, it's Paul Anderson, Ben Bova, Arthur C. Clarke, Frederick Pohl, Greg Egan, Larry Niven, Isaac Asimov. These are writers I'm not particularly crazy about because I think they put so much stock in the picking of nits, and there's not much room for what we talked about before, wonder. It's about getting it right.
Yeah.
And it's about being very straight ahead. One of the reasons I love science fiction is the fiction part of it, the pushing us beyond where we are now. And if it's purely about dials and switches and the physics of the thing, it loses me.
Well, I mean, great science fiction is always about when it's written. You know, it's never about when it's set. I mean, I know I've mentioned on this show before, I think Joe Haldeman's novel, The Forever War, which deals with relativity much more explicitly than Interstellar does even, where these, you know, these space marines, basically they're missing entire epochs of life on Earth while they're out there in space, and the humanity is evolving into this race that they can't even relate to while they're flying around shooting their guns. But that was a book came out in 1974 and was basically written about his experiences in Vietnam.
Right.
You know, it's kind of this anti-war novel disguised as a space thing.
One movie that I wanted to bring up is Contact, which is absolutely in the category of what we're talking about and is a very wonder-based film.
Like Interstellar, that is a Kip Thorne-derived
property. Oh, is it really?
Yeah, the same physicist who worked on Interstellar.
And Carl Sagan. The book was written by Carl Sagan.
Right. And it's definitely Carl Sagan. There's also, at the center of it, a daughter reaching out to her missing father. Mm-hmm. That is a big through line in that movie. It also has Matthew McConaughey in it.
Yep.
As
it
a
does.
Completely dispensable love interest. And I know there
are... I know he represents God and the great God versus science.
I had to look up how old he is when I remember that he was in Contact. I was, wait,
Contact
1997.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, wait, so he would have been... Anyway, I guess he's like 27 in that movie.
He's also older than you think.
No. He looks good.
But that film is extremely focused on wonder and is somewhat divisive. There are people who find that... There are people who hate the payoff of that movie because that movie is building and building and building to a central ending that you're just waiting to sort of see what is at the other end of this journey. I really loved that film.
I like Contact a lot.
And I think in part there were elements of that that I could relate to in my own life that I found very powerful at the time. That is a space exploration movie that I found they worked very hard to establish the warmth. And there's a marvelous Jodie Foster performance at the center of it. And, you know, where that movie has these, for its time, incredible visuals, but is still very much about human emotions that were relatable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got that line I quoted all the time where she says they should have sent a poet. Mm-hmm. And I use that to describe, you know, whatever.
Is that where that's from?
That's where I take that from. And every time I eat like a large hamburger and I'm asked how it is, I'll say they should have sent a poet. I use it constantly.
You do say that.
But that line is marvelous. And that line is all about wonder.
Yeah. It was interesting when I was thinking about this. I was thinking about space and what role space plays in films, particularly in kind of American popular films. And I was thinking about the fact that I think it plays the role of the ocean. You know, it mm-hmm. plays the role of the ocean in seafaring movies. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I liked to touch back on Interstellar is that there is an explicit callback to that relationship between sailing an ocean and being in space. I think a lot of times when you watch space movies, what you're really seeing is a little person floating in a boat in a big ocean, which that we can relate to. And that even if you haven't been in space, you have maybe been on a boat in a big body of water and felt that weird feeling of distance from everything and, you know, the encapsulating of yourself and the smallness of your craft. And that is something that I think that if you're looking for an echo of sort of old cultural storytelling prior to when we started telling stories about astronauts, but in terms of a specific kind of astronaut space travel thing, I think of it as a child of storytelling about, you know, boats sailing the ocean.
Well, and conversely, I would say it's also a metaphor for confinement. And you take, for example, a movie like Kill Bill, which is not a space movie, but where Uma Thurman...
Wait, I need to see that again.
But Uma Thurman at one point is buried alive. And you have this very tense, very terrifying scene of her trying to claw her way out. And that's been done, obviously, in other movies as well. In a way, there are a lot of similarities that you are completely unable to escape your surroundings. And so you not only feel very small, set against this gigantic, unforgiving vastness, but you are pinned to one place within it. When you watch that as an audience member, you feel that very powerfully. You can relate to being boxed in. It's kind of ironic that space is so claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm. I would compare that to the experience of traveling in boats. And I think exactly what you're talking about is right. It plays on that tension between closed in and then out there, there's nothing. It's the, as you said, vastness of what you're in and the tininess of what you're inside. And it's interesting to me that there is, in Interstellar there is, and in Gravity there is, and in Apollo 13, which of course is not fiction, there is this idea that the craft that you're in is getting smaller and more vulnerable.
Right.
When Steven talks about the ratcheting up of tension, I think one of the ways they do that in space movies is like, well, first you're in the big thing and then you got to move to the little capsule. I think that happens in Gravity.
Oh, it definitely does.
Well,
on the podcast, I remember joking about Gravity that they unleash so many perils on her that you're expecting them at one point to unleash the space hornets.
Right, in the capsule. Because
now the small capsule is on fire.
Right, you know? So you keep moving to these smaller and smaller confined spaces. So it's almost like the thing that is most upsetting and weird about that, you keep moving into littler and littler spaces that aren't really meant to be lived in.
I mean, I think another thing that makes the sort of far-flung fantasy of space movies something universally relatable is one of the qualities that makes Alien such a touchstone in this world, which is that it's about blue-collar workers. You know, being in space is a job for them. It's not a privilege. There's nothing exciting about it. They'd clearly rather be at home. Mm-hmm. And I think that, in addition to the great design and everything, is what's given that film such an afterlife.
Let's talk about that, because in terms of design, in terms of how we picture the future, Alien, in 1979, was hugely influential. Now, when I think of Star Wars, which came out in 77, I picture that very first scene on the Rebel Blockade Runner, white walls, white kind of molded plastic, pristine, clear. That seems
to me... It's
an
Apple store.
Yeah, it seems to me to belong to the kind of, 2001 design. Mm-hmm. The film 2001, very burnt ochre cushions and white. Alien comes along in 1979, a lot of metal grating. Mm-hmm. Lots of metal walkways and stairways. It's basically an iron foundry in space. And as I say this out loud, it sounds like the gay guy is going, couldn't there be some fabrics? Shouldn't there be some textiles? We should have some throw cushions.
I know that's not what you're saying.
That's not what I'm saying. Throw cushions aren't even a thing. Throw pillows. I'm not a good gay. Anyway.
How do you throw them in weightlessness?
Thank you. The point is that so much that has come since Alien has aped that look of the Nostromo. Has that things are dark, things are dripping, everything's metal. Industrial.
Have you seen the documentary Yadorovsky's Dune?
Yes, indeed.
And that's about the making of the planned making, not ever actually made, version of Dune that was going to be directed by this very, very avant-garde. And like, this is an avant-garde, like slight weirdo calls self avant-garde. Like,
ew.
He was an avant-garde director. Mm-hmm. And was supposed to make this version of Dune that never got made, but in the process of putting together the team for that, brought together a lot of the people who later worked on Alien.
Right.
So if you're interested in this kind of thing and kind of the aesthetics of space and the aesthetics of futurism and stuff like that, I'll provide a link to that documentary. Again, it's called Yadorovsky's Dune, and it's super fascinating, I think.
I loved
that movie. You know, I would love to hear what folks have to say about your favorite space movies, your favorite hard science fiction, and come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and tell us what you think. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, at the risk of promoting stuff that I'm involved with, last week NPR Music had kind of a staggeringly successful week in a couple of ways. We launched a beautiful redesign of our homepage at NPR Music that I highly recommend people check out, and we inaugurated the launch of that homepage by publishing a Tiny Desk concert with T-Pain, who is known for singing in autotune and was on virtually every hit song from the year 2005 to about the year 2010. I think most people know this by now, but we had, just last week, T-Pain come into the office and sing his ass off. The last time I checked, the YouTube of the T-Pain Tiny Desk concert had soared past 5 million, which is more than twice the count of any Tiny Desk concert we've ever done, including Adele. It's really remarkable, and it was just this wonderful experience to be part of something that went viral that you also happen to be very proud of.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very good week to be with NPR Music. The other thing that I did, completely unrelated, is I finally sat down with my kids and watched the movie The Emperor's New Groove.
Mm-hmm.
The Emperor's New Groove, it is about a typically cocky Disney emperor played by David Spade, kind of steering into the skid in full David Spade douchiness, who is turned into a llama in part as punishment for his actions and his attempts to become not a llama, which is a shockingly fun and enjoyable little movie. It's only about 75 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
You can fit...
Stephen loves a short
Well, you can fit several of it into Interstellar.
Into any Chris Nolan movie.
And still make change. But it's so funny and so quotable. And we watched it once on Sunday night and then just watched it again on Monday night because it's so incredibly fun. The Emperor's New Groove, it's from like 2000, so it was just an era when I wasn't watching every animated movie that was coming
David
out.
David Spade, Patrick Warburton.
Patrick Warburton is so good. And Eartha Kitt is unbelievable.
Who are
in
both
movie.
In the series that followed it, the television series that followed it. David Spade went off, and they had a sound alike. But it's still very funny. It's still really smartly
written. They couldn't get a Spade.
Yeah.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Well, pay attention, Stephen Thompson. Hat tip to the Mary Sue for alerting me to the Internet Arcade.
Yes.
At archive.org/details/Internet Arcade. Old school arcade games, close to 400 of them, all playable for free on your computer. It's a browser-based emulations, but they are very, very good emulations. Does it have your basics, your Pac-Mans, your Dig Dugs, your Stargates, your Q-Berts, your Froggers, your Jousts, your Galagas, your Defenders? Yes, of course it does. Does it have Tempest? No, unfortunately it does not.
Tempest is really tricky to emulate. You gotta have a dial.
You gotta have the trackball. Doesn't have Battlezone, which was, as the kids say, my jam, and it doesn't have Dragon's Lair, of course, but I think you can find some of these on other around the net. It also has games I've never heard of. I didn't realize there was a Krull video game. I didn't realize there was an Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom video game where maybe you rip out somebody's heart, let's hope, and then a Three Stooges video game.
Wow.
Who knew? And, of course, Steven Zaxxon and Super Zaxxon.
Yes!
archive.org/details/Internet Arcade.
Wonderful. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
You know, I was going to say recommend a play that is at Signature Theater in Arlington right outside of Washington, D.C. right now by Laura Eason, who is a playwright who is also a writer on House of Cards for seasons 2 and 3 called Sex with Strangers. But since all I feel like I ever do when I'm in here is recommend plays, what is making me happy this week was going through looking for clips from some of the great space films we talked about. And there was one in particular, kind of the primary source document for the entire genre, the Magna Carta, a space odyssey, if you will. Jessica, please.
A space convoy on a strange voyage, carrying a rare cargo. The forests, the plants, the growing things doomed to extinction on Earth.
We have just received orders to abandon and nuclear destruct all the forests and return our ships to commercial service.
Man, we're going home!
Up this forest.
We're gonna nuclear destruct all the
yeah,
forests.
Yeah.
Silent running.
This is Silent Running. Douglas Trumbull, the visual effects genius who worked on 2001 and Close Encounters and Blade Runner, is still remembered as a visual effects genius and not as a director, because when he was a director, he directed Silent Running. But this kind of fits in nicely with Interstellar. You know, it's a pessimistic 70s eco-disaster movie where all of the biodiversity of Earth has pretty much died off, and we're preserving the last of it in these floating geodomes out in space. Looking at the way advertising for sci-fi seems to age much more rapidly than the great sci-fi films do is a source of endless amusement for me. So what's making me happy is that clip. And another one from the same trailer. Jess, can we get number 2?
Meet the almost human drones, amazing companions on a journey beyond the stars.
The man has a full house in New York.
This is Bruce Dern playing cards with the robot.
Oh,
boy. Here, Joan Baez sing Rejoice in the Sun and Fire.
And there are Joan Baez.
I like Joan Baez. That. That's an unfair moment.
Well, you didn't like the music in Interstellar, so.
No, that's true. Well, because where, I meant to say this before, where Inception has Interstellar has to me, it's kind of worse.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Chris Klimek. As many of you are aware, partly because I mentioned it when we were starting the show, I am freshly back from vacation. I had a lovely road trip all around New England. Thanks to everybody, you know, big ups to the Land Ho on Cape Cod, and where I had some really good chowder. Big ups to the Lone Wolf right by Amherst, where I had breakfast. It's super awesome. Lots of great and lovely people. But I also spent a lot of time driving. And whenever I spend a lot of time driving, I listen to all sorts of things. And on one particular day when I had a very long drive, I listened pretty much all day to episodes of This American Life on the This American Life app. Now, as Gene Demby mentioned on the show when I was not here, everyone loves Serial, right? Mm-hmm. The new podcast from Sarah Koenig, put out by This American Life family. It is their new podcast, and I love Serial. I'm a huge fan of Serial. I think it's a terrific show. I really do want to stress to people, though, it's This American Life. So the fact that everybody is like, ooh, cereal's cool. Now we're going to talk about cereal like it's cool, like it's an HBO show. if you're saying that right now, you're taking Ira Glass for granted, because that's what it is. It's This American Life, only longer. That's what it is. So what I'm saying is, if you're finding yourself telling all your friends, oh, I love cereal. I just love cereal. It's so great. Go back and listen to some freaking episodes of This American Life. We also should mention, before we go, that we are having a live show on December 9th here in Washington at 6th and I. And we put our tickets on sale while I was on vacation on a particular lovely day at noon. We put our tickets on sale, and they sold out, depending on your definition, they sold out in about 3 hours. Yeah. And so we just want to say we did a better job of not having them sell out in 10 seconds or 12 minutes.
Well, and we did that by putting a number of tickets on sale that
That's right.
equivalent to our last three shows combined.
Absolutely. And so we have a much bigger show, and hopefully we'll get to do more of those. But to those of you who lined up and jumped on and got tickets, we're going to be super excited to see you, and we're super excited to have everybody's support, and it was really wonderful. And we will try to put together a show worthy of your enthusiasm. And that is all that is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek. That's CTKLIMEK. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's REEDY. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Ever wonder why textbooks are so expensive? How fondue pots came to be on every wedding registry? Why there are so few female computer programmers? Our friends at Planet Money answer great questions like these on their podcast. They have new episodes every Wednesday and Friday, and you can find them on iTunes.